Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This is just one segment of today's show. You can hear all of our conversations about New York's vibrant cultural scene on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer at 93.9 WNYC and WNYC.org. All this week, as we've done at the end of each of the past few years, we'll be inviting critics to come in and look at some of the best in the music world in 2005. It was a breakthrough year on several fronts in music technology. Podcasting went mainstream, music download services seemed more popular than ever, and everyone seemed to be walking around with white cords dangling from their ears. At the same time, the music industry went to war with its customers, seeking to curb music piracy and illegal file sharing. Joining us with the year's highlights in music technology is David Pogue. He is the technology columnist for the New York Times and a correspondent for CBS News, and joins us occasionally on Soundcheck as well. He does so today from the studios of WSHU in Connecticut. David, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
So we're starting this year-long look at 2005 in music by looking at not the music itself, but how we get it, which says something about the music world in 2005.
That's true. It's coming at us from every direction, via satellite, via internet, via electronic device. There's never been a greater choice in ways to get your music.
All right. Now, it seems to have also been a big year on the legal front. Would you say that is one of the key sort of stories in the music technology world this year?
I'd say it is the key story. I mean, it's hard to compete with free, the saying goes, but that is how millions and millions of young people in particular got their music, especially pop music, with free download sites and illegal ones like Kazaa and Grokster. And here comes the recording industry of America, the RIAA, with lawsuits and other plans to drive these folks out of business. And sure enough, they have actually made headway. I never thought they'd do it, but they've shut down Grokster. They're making progress in shutting down the other companies. More and more people are turning to legitimate paid music download services like iTunes, and it blows my mind, but it looks like the RIAA might actually make a dent.
So one of the big developments this year was in the realm of legal downloading, and that is what has often been described as a rental plan. Tell us about this.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, everybody knows that from the iTunes Music Store, you can download songs at $1 each and own them forever. But there's this other plan that's slowly gaining traction where you pay $10 or $15 a month and you download all the songs you want. You can fill up your hard drive with music and even put it on a player, not an iPod, but another player, and take it with you. The catch being that you don't really own it. The day you stop paying your $15 a month, you lose it all. You're left with nothing but the fond memories.
So it's like magic. It just disappears off of your player once you stop paying.
The files are there, but they die. They no longer will play. And but I see it as a spectrum. So at one end is, you know, the radio. You turn it on and it's free and there's music you can listen to, but you have no control over what you're listening to, which bands, which styles. You're at the mercy of the radio hosts, although I have the utmost respect for them. Then at the
present company accepted, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. And if they're smart, they'll listen to this one. At the other end of the spectrum is the iTunes model, where you buy songs a la carte and you own them. But in between is a widening array. So we mentioned the rental services, but there's also satellite radio, where you can't say, I want this song or this band, but because they have 150 channels, you can definitely say, I want to listen to reggae right now. You know, you can mm-hmm. definitely listen by style. And there are all kinds of other variations. There are radio stations online where you can cherry pick the bands you want to hear over time. You can't say when and you can't say which songs, but those are even less expensive. And by the way, I'm not one to plug anything, but I do want to mention Rhapsody.com. You can't compete with free. This is free and legal. They will let you listen to 25 songs a month for free. You don't even have to give them your credit card number. It just became available for Macs and Linux, and it's always been available for Windows. And the thing I find interesting about this program, which is obviously meant to be a teaser for mm-hmm. their paid program, is that for a long time the pirates argued it's okay to pirate and trade these songs illegally. It's actually good for the recording industry. Listen to this logic. We discover new songs this way. We hear some great band we'd never heard of because a friend sent it to us, and then we go out and buy the CD. See, it's good for you. Well, whether you buy that logic or not, now it's being put to the test by this Rhapsody program, because indeed you can go listen legally this time, not to a 30-second preview, but to the entire song, and then decide if you want to go out and buy the whole thing.
Well, now, why would you buy it if you already have it for free? Is this another one of those things that disappears from your player in a month?
Well, oh, not even that. It doesn't get to your player. The Rhapsody free thing is just listening at your computer.
It's just
streaming.
Okay.
But, you know, I have to admit that, you know, I have an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old, and I will often be telling them about some song, you know, oh, is this song called Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds? And it's hard to explain, you know. And then I would go home and buy it from iTunes and spend $1 so they could go, oh, Dad, okay. Now I don't have to spend money on that. They can listen to it for free.
Okay. So Rhapsody, you think, of this spectrum of, I have to say, somewhat bewildering choices of how to get your music, that's one that you think people might actually get some use out of.
Well, it's just for the non-junkie, if you don't listen to more than 25 a month, as I don't really need to buy 25 songs a month, it's a really great program Rhapsody is actually paying the record companies every time you listen to one of these things. So they're literally paying your bill.
Wow. We're speaking with David Pogue, who is the technology columnist for the New York Times, and looking at some of the highlights of 2005 in music technology. And as you said, David, sort of the big story was this whole development of a spectrum of legal music services. What else has made news? I would assume Sprint and their online music store is sort of a related but somewhat different story.
You know, it's just hilarious to watch these technology companies try to bank on what's going to be the next big thing. And sometimes they miss it entirely. I mean, they've spent hundreds of billions of dollars over the last 5 years trying to get us all to have the connected living room, where our internet and our computers are all connected to our TV. And so far, nobody's buying. Well, here's the next one they're telling us is going to be huge. Music on your cell phone. Who needs the iPod? You're already carrying around a gadget. What, do we want to look like Batman with a utility belt filled with gadgets? So first came the Motorola Rocker phone, R-O-K-R, which is the first cell phone that can play songs you've bought from the iTunes store. And the music quality is excellent. The battery life is good. People generally hated it, though, because it holds only 100 songs. You know, that's enough for, you know, one of my typical workouts, but
right,
not much longer.
Right.
and also, it doesn't look – it wasn't designed by Apple. It doesn't look anything like the coolness of the iPod. It was designed by Motorola, enough said. So then this other new development, the Sprint music phone, this one lets you actually buy, shop, and download songs directly to the phone from wherever you happen to be, unlike the Motorola, which must be loaded up from your computer. So you're on the road somewhere, and someone says, have you heard the latest song by, you know, whoever? And you say, no, but I will in just a second. So the wrinkle there is the Sprint executives got so excited about this prospect. Oh, my gosh, iPod plus cell phone. It'll be huge. That they've priced these songs at $2.50 plus tax each. I mean, are they out of their gourds? I mean, I can tell you nobody's going to pay $2.50 a song. They keep trying to say, but this is not for the iPod fanatic. This is for a new kind of customer. Yeah, okay, a rich one.
Mm-hmm. And one who has a pretty broad view of what classical music means, because apparently Tom Jones, Bob Dylan, and David Bowie are all listed classically. Yeah, they're all under classical in Sprint's little music store there.
You know, in their world, we're all really old. Those are considered classical music already. The system has a few glitches to be worked out, and the browse-by-category system is one notable kink.
All right, so the logic behind this is what? That people will give up their iPods because they're already carrying around cell phones, and that we're just going to get bigger and better hard drives on our cell phones?
Well, that's pretty much it. iTunes Music Store has sold 500 million songs now, and by the way, already 3 million television shows now they've sold already in just a couple of months. But that's another conversation. Shall I see you tomorrow at this time? So Sprint executives are saying, wow, iPod times teenagers divided by 250 a song. I mean, they're just doing the math. And I will say, one of the things that made the iPod so successful, although it wasn't the first hard drive music player by any means, is the simplicity of it. It's just so easy to use and so simple. Now, think how easy to use it would have to be on your cell phone where mm-hmm. you have only a 2-inch screen. And by golly, they nailed it. It is really, really easy and fast and simple to use, to find a song and buy it. So I was impressed that they didn't manage to screw that up, as these companies so often do.
Right.
It's just the pricing.
What about the evolution of iPod to its current video format? What do you make of that?
You know, it's Steve Jobs himself, the CEO of Apple, frequently said that the video iPod concept would never take off because you can't do something else while you're doing it as you can when you're listening to music on a regular iPod. I mean, my wife is a surgeon, and I can tell you that surgeons listen to music when they're operating.
Right.
But I do not want to be operated on by someone who's watching Desperate Housewives at the same time. So you have to be careful with that. And yet, here it is, the video iPod that lets you download TV shows for $2, which, by the way, I think is a terrific price. A 3-minute song is $1, so why shouldn't a 30-minute show with no commercials in perfect quality be $2? Anyway, so they have actually taken off to the extent you might expect. I mean, there are some downsides to this. This is only adding to the further isolation and splintering of the American populace. I'm man enough to admit this. The first time I had a video iPod to try out, Apple had loaded it up with an episode of Lost. I was walking through a long tunnel in Grand Central Station, and I kid you not, I walked into a steel post. It is completely engrossing. People say, but it's only a 2.5-inch screen.
Yeah.
But what they forget is it's a 2.5-inch screen, 11 inches from your eyes. So it's the same size of your field of view as a plasma across the room.
Well, but David, it sounds like there's a certain dork factor involved in walking around with, you know, a little 2-inch screen that you're holding 11 inches in front of your face.
Boy, you really know how to butter up your guests. It's just about the commute, you know. It's about killing those dead times when you're waiting for the dentist appointment or you're in the line at the Department of Motor Vehicles. It's another way to kill that time. And yes, it's also another decline in the common cultural base we used to have. I mean, nobody says, oh, did you see the Carol Burnett show last night on one of the only 3 channels
right.
we have? So that whole thing is collapsing quickly. It's going to be more individualized than ever. But, you know, technology marches on.
All right. Well, and there are, of course, always those what's that old technology, the one with the paper pages that you turn and it's got the books. You know?
What's the battery life on those things?
Yeah. You get all these things, obviously, you know, Apple sent you the video iPod to try out. After all this, after everything you've seen in the past 12 months, what do you want for Christmas?
You know, I think I don't get to keep this stuff, by the way.
Right.
I sell it on eBay. No. I have to return it all. But I will say that video iPod was such a liberating experience, and not just for me walking into steel girders, but also
once the welts went down, you were happy to have it.
But for my children, you know, my son had a Taekwondo tournament up in Connecticut, and it was a four-hour thing, and my daughter came along to watch, but it turned out most of the 4 hours was sitting around and waiting, and I did quizzes with her, I did guessing games, and I just was running out. So I handed her the video iPod. It had a couple episodes of That's So Raven on it,
mm-hmm.
and she was transported. You know, I don't know. Was I being a good parent? I don't know. But it was so useful, and it allowed me to focus on my son in his tournament.
You were being a practical parent, that's for sure.
That's right.
David Pogue is technology columnist for The New York Times and a correspondent for CBS News and joins us occasionally on Soundcheck to talk about matters technological. And David, happy holidays to you, and we'll talk again in the new year.
Thank you, and to you too.
This is Soundcheck.
I watched it for a little while. I like to watch things on TV. Satellite of love. Satellite of love. Satellite of love.
Coming up in a moment, how music played a prominent role in the movies this year. We'll have film scholar John Tibbetts joining us. Stay tuned. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and all this week we are looking back at the best of 2005. In a little while, we'll have a live performance in our studio by jazz pianist Rand Blake, whose compositions are often inspired by film, and especially film noir. Right now, we're going to take a look at the best music in the movies this year. Everything from hip-hop to country to opera showed up on the big screen. John Tibbetts is an associate professor in the Department of Theater and Film at the University of Kansas. John is author of the book Composers in the Movies, Studies in Musical Biographies. He joins us from his home out there in the heartland. John, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Hi, John. Glad to be here.
So in Sunday's New York Times, A.O. Scott argued that 2005 was a year in movies that didn't have big, big hits, didn't have big, big flops, that it was a whole lot of mediocre. What's your assessment?
Well, in all humility, not really. I can't really agree with that. There were lots of surprises, some of them welcome, some of them not so welcome. So I prefer the surprise factor to be operative here.
Okay. Now, you suggested that we open this segment with that music from Wagner, The Entrance of the Gods into Valhalla. Why?
Well, not only is Wagner continuing to be a staple in Hollywood, the music shows up everywhere. But in Terrence Malick's new film, The New World, which has not opened yet in a lot of places, listeners and viewers might be startled to find that when Colin Farrell discovers the shores of Virginia, he does so to the music of The Entrance of the Gods into Valhalla.
Hmm.
Now, I'm not quite sure what kind of correlation we have there between the gods entering Valhalla and Colin Farrell entering the Virginia Harbor. But hey, why not? In fact, Terrence Malick is so in love with this particular connection that he uses that music no less than three times in the film, just in case we didn't get it in the first place, I guess.
All right. Well,
he is in the habit of doing this sort of thing in other pictures. We recall music by Carl Orff in Badlands, and in Days of Heaven we had music by Saint-Saëns, and so here we have Wagner. And by the way, we also had music by Wagner in Jarhead, when we see the Marines watching clips from Apocalypse Now.
Right.
So it's all boxes within boxes here.
All right. And is there some sense that using classical music in your film will give it a certain cachet?
There was a time, I think, when film producers seriously thought that. But nowadays, when classical and pop and hip-hop and everything else rub shoulders, I'm not so sure that's the case anymore. But maybe there's a name recognition, a tune recognition. Ride of the Valkyries is always showing up in cartoons and everywhere else. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's not so much the prestige factor, but the opulence of the sound. Whether people recognize it as Wagner or not, I think is irrelevant. Hopefully they'll be swept up in the monumentality of the music as we watch Malick's Images.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to some of your best of for 2005. I mean, there was a lot of music in the movies this year. Where should we start?
And among my best ofs, at least my best surprises, would be Tim Burton's Corpse Bride. Danny Elfman, of course, has had a long association with Burton, and I would have expected a very interesting soundtrack, which we have in Corpse Bride. But what was a surprise to me is that the film basically is a musical, and there are some marvelously inventive musical numbers in Corpse Bride, including a beautiful piano duet between the main character and the title character. I haven't seen a film in a long time where the filmmakers take time for several minutes to sit down and let its performers just fiddle around at the piano, which is happening here. It's marvelous. And there are other musical numbers throughout the picture that I'm surprised have not been getting more recognition. They were sure swell with me, as they say.
Well, Tim Burton and Danny Elfman had collaborated before a number of times, most notably, I guess, The Nightmare Before Christmas, which really was a musical.
Yeah, I think both of them must be thinking music in images and images in music.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're at the top of your form like these guys are, you really can't tell the difference. The two achieve a synergy that is so compelling. And ever since I saw Corpse Bride, I've been going around trying to drum up enthusiasm for the music score. Haven't had much success so far, but maybe you can help me out.
Well, Danny Elfman doesn't really need our help, does he?
I mean, you got a point there.
He's the guy who wrote the Batman score and, of course, the theme for The Simpsons and so much more. And this is The Wedding Song from The Corpse Bride.
A wedding.
That is some of Danny Elfman's music for the Tim Burton film The Corpse Bride. And my guest is John Tibbetts.
Gilbert and Sullivan.
There is a little kind of operetta thing happening, not just in Corpse Bride, but in Nightmare Before Christmas as well.
Yep.
And I feel it's sort of incumbent upon me to point out that Danny Elfman is a rocker. I mean, this is the guy who led the band Oingo Boingo, later Boingo. So, I mean, here's a guy who can rock with the best of them, but is clearly a very literate and sophisticated composer as well.
Yeah, well, when you have Randy Newman, you know, turning to the Hollywood scores as he has, it takes any musician working in Hollywood or in films generally has to have as an eclectic a background as possible, and you're absolutely right.
John Tibbetts is with us on the phone from Kansas. He is associate professor at the University of Kansas and author of the book Composers in the Movies, Studies in Musical Biographies. We're looking at some of the best music in the movies in 2005. We started with The Corpse Bride. And, John, what else do you got?
Well, maybe on the distaff side, the singing by Joaquin Phoenix, doubling for Johnny Cash in Walk the Line, I found very disappointing. I admire the fact that he tried it. It gets close sometimes. But here's a case where I almost wish they would have dubbed in the vocals. I generally don't like that practice, but for example, in the scene where Cash sits down with Sam Phillips at the Sun Studios in Memphis and auditions, that's a key scene. And we're supposed to see Phillips pretty much overwhelmed by the unique characteristic of Cash's voice. But instead, I was not overwhelmed by the not-so-unique characteristics of Joaquin Phoenix's voice.
Mm-hmm.
There's a credibility factor there that was lost on me because what I was hearing would not have been what would have so inspired Sam Phillips. Too bad. On the other hand, I thought Reese Witherspoon did an admirable job with her vocals.
Okay. Now, does that sort of concern with, you know, how the music is really sounding within the arc of the narrative, does that come into play with something like Rent, for example?
They're trying as much as they can to open up Rent, in contradistinction to the producers, which is left in kind of a theatrical manner. And so because they've opened it up so much, they have to depend upon voice dubbing. And that's okay. I think we understand the conceit there, so we go along with it. I just wish the score were more memorable. I may be in the minority on that. But
the score
number
of Rent.
About lighting the candles, I thought was quite captivating. But some of the rest of it just kind of went over my head, I'm afraid. But instead, it was fun watching Christopher Columbus trying to open up this thing beyond the tenement rooms.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Light a Candle. Okay. This is from Rent. My guest is John Tibbetts from the University of Kansas. We're talking about the best music in the movies in 2005. Would you light my candle? What are you staring at? Nothing. Your hair in the moonlight. You look familiar. Can you make it? Just haven't eaten much today. At least the room stopped spinning. Anyway, what? Nothing. Your smile reminded me of... I always remind people of... Who is she? She died. Her name was April. It's out again. Sorry about your friends. Would you like my candle? All right, that is from Rent. John Tibbetts, once you start peeling back the layers of Rent, I mean, it's based, obviously, on the musical, which in turn is based on the Puccini opera La Boheme.
Well, just in case we didn't get the point, we have several soundtrack excerpts from La Boheme, and of course we have a big musical showstopper, La Vie Boheme, where everybody is kicking up their heels. I think I could have done without the overt references to the Puccini score. I don't know that the two necessarily need to be foregrounded as much as they are here, because I came out of the movie going, it ain't no La Boheme.
Yeah.
But indeed, it's not La Boheme. And the fact that it's a wannabe La Boheme, I think, is a failure of aspiration here. And also, I think it does a disservice to the very real tragedies going on in the lives of these characters. This is not a pasteboard, theatrically artificial story that's being told here, although I'm afraid, as I emerged from the film, it kind of seemed that way, a soft center to what should have been a much more gritty presentation.
So do you think that any of these scores that we're talking about today would actually have done anything to get viewers in the theater out to the opera, off to Broadway? I mean, to follow what? To the record store to buy Johnny Cash? I mean, do you think the scores did anything other than support the action on screen?
I'm sure that there will be examples of that happening, but, you know, I cannot think of any major example of what you're talking about. Now, I, for one, came out of Mrs. Henderson Presents. Is that playing in New York now?
I believe it is, yeah.
I came out of Mrs. Henderson Presents wanting to look up more British music hall standards from the first half of the 20th century.
All right, now Mrs. Henderson Presents, this is the World War II era.
Mm-hmm. Judi Dench portrays a real-life character who bought a theater in the late 30s, actually earlier than that, and during the war years kept it open with music hall and vaudeville routines, kept it open 24/7. And so we have an opportunity to see and hear some songs that are new to the score, but some other songs, like a thing called The Girl with the Green Hat, is absolutely charming, that really carry and evoke that wonderful era, a bygone era, of the British music hall. I, for one, want to check out more of that sort of thing. It's a wonderful film, by the way.
Mrs. Henderson Presents is the name of the film, and this is the song, The Girl with the Little Green Hat.
Oh, excellent. Good for you.
There's a lake in the park. There's a house by the lake. There's a girl in the house by the lake in the park. And the girl in the house in the park by the lake is the girl in the little green hat. And tonight after eight, that's when I've got to date. When the moon's riding high and the stars light the sky. With the girl in the house by the lake in the park. The girl in
what?
The little green hat.
You better see
there's
it for
no
yourself.
There's no water in the lake. There's no roof upon the house. No trees is in the park at all. But she'll wait beside the lake, I'll be welcome at the house.
So this is actually from the film itself. It's part of a scene during what is obviously a rehearsal within the theater. John Tibbetts is my guest, associate professor at the University of Kansas, author of the book Composers in the Movies, Studies in Musical Biographies. We're talking about sort of major musical events on the big screen in 2005, both for good and, in the case of Rent, for the perhaps not so good. But you think Mrs. Henderson Presents, the movie that this song comes from, will get at least some people more interested in looking at British Dance Hall, which, after all, was, I mean, that was like one of the big influences on the Beatles.
Oh, absolutely. And although I haven't noticed it yet, when that soundtrack album comes out, I'm going to be first in line. Again, it's one of those surprises, John. I'm not going to say it's great or wonderful or anything like that so much as it was just an agreeable surprise to me. And if I might also mention Hustle and Flow, which is not necessarily a movie I'd be, you know, running right out to be the first to see either, but gosh, what a captivating performance by Terrence Howard, and wonderful sequences in which they kind of recreate what might go into hip-hop music making. They're doing it in shabby circumstances, they're on the cheap, they're trying to put together a demo, and watching the creative process happen there is just a special, special thing that movies do sometimes.
Well, now, Hustle and Flow was one of three sort of major film releases that dealt with hip-hop. I mean, there was Rise
is another.
And then, of course, 50 Cent's movie, Get Rich or Die Trying.
Mm-hmm.
So that certainly seemed to be a kind of a trend in the making.
Rise, of course, is a film that hits you, grabs you by the scruff of the neck and won't let you go till it's done.
That's
the
one about the
high-energy film of the year.
That's the one about the dancing in L.A.
Yeah, the crumps and the clowns.
Yeah.
And a kind of an alternative to street violence transformed into a dance violence where the rivalries, the competitions between the two gangs of dancers become, every bit as violent, really, as the street scene itself. Wonderful film, and I definitely am going to put it up as one of the top two or three documentaries of the year.
All right. John, let's come back to the Johnny Cash biopic, Walk the Line. Do you think the, I mean, there seem to be, as there always are, mixed reviews for this film. Do you think that the music kind of helped to carry the script? I mean, it certainly was central to the story.
Well, I think for many it did. For myself, it did not, because I kept worrying about why isn't the voice we hear from Joaquin Phoenix of a kind, why doesn't it have the gravitas that we really need for Cash? Also, biopics generally, they don't give us enough of the behind-the-scenes. What goes into the workshop?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are they doing with their music? Now, maybe producers don't think audiences are interested, but I think they are. We want to know, what is the rehearsal process? How do these songs come to being? What's the nature of the collaboration, the changes that are made on the way to a finished project, a finished product? It's not there. Entirely too much space, in my opinion, is devoted to just another kind of melodramatic love story, a love me or leave me type thing. We've seen it 1,000 times. What is it about Cash that's unique? The voice, the being on the road, the processes of putting together concert programs, all of that is noticeably absent for me.
All right, so the Walk the Line is one of a number of films that we've been talking about with John Tibbetts, and in fact, all of the movies that we've been talking about are listed on our website. You can go to the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org. Sounds like a really big thumbs up for The Corpse Bride.
Yeah.
The Tim Burton-Danny Elfman collaboration, and Mrs. Henderson Presents, something you'll be following up on as well. John Tibbetts, always a pleasure to have you on Soundcheck. Thanks for being with us today, and happy holidays.
And watch for Copying Beethoven, Agnieszka Holland's new biopic about Beethoven, coming out this winter.
All right.
Yes.
Thank you, John.
Okay, John. Thank
this
you.
Is Soundcheck.
Strangest kind of way. Play a strain.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast of Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. and thanks.